and welcome back to Railway Mania. Today we're going to talk about the story of a luxury express sleeper train travelling through dangerous territory. En route, the train is deliberately derailed and the passengers are kidnapped. The hostages include a journalist, the wealthy daughter of a Rhode Island senator, a French businessman, a gangster, and two US Army majors. The kidnappers are made up of several bandit factions working together under a charismatic 25-year-old leader on the run from an army trying to exterminate him and his band of outlaws. This sounds like the plot to an action-adventure film, but this story is true and is the subject of The Peking Express by James M. Zimmerman. James, welcome to Railway Mania.
Thank you for the opportunity.
What I want to ask you first is, how did you come across this story?
Well, I was working on another writing project, specifically early 20th century China, and I noticed that there was a lot of attention to the Peking Express story in the media, you know, back in 1923, and it was extensive coverage for the entire 37-day hostage crisis. And I mean, more I read that there was a lot of government reports, there was a lot of information that was about the incident, but it seemed to be forgotten, probably because of World War II, the Japanese invasion of China, and a lot of other historical things that were happening at the time. And so what I did was I dug into the government records and archives around the world. But when I knew I had a really good story to tell when I tracked down the records of the descendants of those involved, you know, in the situation, like the hostages, as well as the rescuers, the negotiators, the government officials. And so the family records were pretty extensive and gave a variety of points of view that were just not in the government records. And so the book itself is really based upon all of the family records, the diaries, the letters, and so forth, you know, that allowed me to put myself into the shoes of an incident, you know, that happened in May of 1923, which had significant impact on not just China, but China's place in the world.
We're going back, well, almost exactly 100 years for this story. So could you outline for us what the political situation is like in China at this time in 1923?
Sure. 1923, could characterize China as very chaotic. It was during what we refer to as the warlord era. You know, just 12 years before that, the Qing government was overruled, was removed, and we saw the beginning of the Republican government. But the Republican government was, you know, a situation where you had one warlord after another from different regions within the country that were fighting one another, that were trying to unify the country. We were in a situation then where, you know, the warlords were all, you know, engaged in battle and factional fighting back and forth. And you had a situation where when one warlord prevailed over another warlord, you had a very large pool of disbanded soldiers that had no place to go. They were armed men, you know, that would be roaming the countryside. The warlords that prevailed, rather than dealing with the situation, you know, disarming the men or finding them jobs and providing them with clothing and food, basically what they did is they engaged in bandit suppression campaigns and then would be going after the bandits and, you know, basically slaughtering them. And at the same time, any of the villagers or the peasants that were supporting the bandits, they too would be, you know, in a situation where they would be also slaughtered. And so, you know, it was a battleground in the rural areas. So this was kind of the political environment at the time. But in the meantime, the warlord government was trying to unify the country. We had a president in place that was focused on putting an end to the warlordism, you know, putting an end to all of these armies. He wanted to have a national constitution, but he was very slow at making this happen. And one of the ideas to unify the country was the use of the railroads. That would not just bring commerce and trade and tourism, but would be able to unify the country because it was really, you know, split up in many, many regions. So the railroad was viewed as a way to bring China to a more modern level. So here you have in May of 1923, you have a lot of investments in the rail system, you had the beginning of the express train system between Shanghai and Beijing. The express trains only started in January of 1923. And so this was a big deal.
And to put it into perspective, what kind of journey time are we talking about between Shanghai and Peking?
Well, think about how the travel between Shanghai and Beijing before the railroads, you had a situation where it would take 5 days, you know, 5 days by ocean-going vessel from Shanghai to get up to Peking. And after they decided to invest in the railroads and specifically the express trains, it shortened the trip to a more predictable 36 hours. And so that was a real big deal. The government also invested a ton of money in very sophisticated technology, specifically the passenger cars, which were all steel, and they were believed to be bulletproof and banditproof.
Well, we'll come back to that. If we talk about the background of the finance that's going into this, presumably at this time in China, there's a lot of Western influence and finance going on.
Right.
So who's funding this project and who benefits from it?
Okay. You know, backing up a bit, you know, China was very, very slow to warm up to the idea of the railroads. The first train line, you know, built by the British was between Shanghai and Wusong, a port of Wusong, and that was in 1876. And the government at the time, the Qing government, approved and disapproved and back and forth and decided to allow it to be built, but it lasted 1 year. And the government tore up the tracks, took the cars, and dumped it in the ocean. So that was 1877. And so fast forward to the turn of the century, China only had about 10 serviceable miles of track. And while the rest of the world in Great Britain, in Europe, in the United States, there was train track crisscrossing the countries, servicing every small town. You know, like in contrast to the 10 miles in China, the United States had 193,000 miles of track. You know, so China was way behind in the time. So when the Qing government came into power, yeah, in 1911, 1912, you know, they started to really encourage more development in railroads. But at that time, the government had no money and had no technology. And so they were inviting bankers from around the world. They were inviting construction companies, rail companies to invest. And in some situations, a lot of the rail lines were actually owned by effectively owned by foreign bankers, foreign interests. So there was a lot of different, it was kind of a messy situation where the rail companies were owned or operated by foreign interests. But the Peking Express line, specifically the what's called the Pukou Tianjin line, that was what the first rail that was vested in the Chinese government, Chinese interest. And that line, I mean, it was kind of the pride of the government to have that line, which is what's going to unify the country as being owned by Chinese interests. But there was, in 1923, there was a lot of different interests involved, and it was supported by, I mean, different ways of revenue that the foreign bankers were being paid back with, and specifically like the salt monopoly that would be paying, you know, for the foreign loans on the rails.
I think we see the foreign interest reflected in the passengers that are on the train. One of the main players in the story describes the situation in China at the time as akin to Europe in the Middle Ages in terms of the lawlessness of it, the different factions, the different areas you have to travel through, different people you have to make deals with. So traveling by this train, obviously you have this speed and the security element, and that will appeal to foreign nationals, and that's who we see on the train. So can we talk a bit about the different people that appear in the story, who become hostages, what their backgrounds are, what they think, and how they've ended up here?
Sure. I mean, you have to imagine yourself at the Shanghai Nanking Railway Station on May 5th, 1923. And in that room, you had almost 300 passengers getting ready to board the train. And you would be able to hear, you know, languages such as English, French, Italian, German, Spanish. You would hear a variety of Chinese dialects. You would hear languages from around Asia. So you had a very, very diverse group of people ready, getting ready to board that train. And so that was the diversity of the passengers actually was a reflection of the diversity of Shanghai at the time. I think most people that were getting ready to board the train felt relatively safe because both the government as well as private companies and the railroads were promoting train travel as very, very safe. One of the leading travel guides of the time, the Handbook for China, this is 1921. It had a whole section on basically banditry and what to expect, and
My
it,
God.
yeah.
What to expect with bandits? What a title.
Right. I mean, just imagine yourself in the train station with your family and you've got kids there and you overhear somebody saying, "We're going through bandit country." But you say, "Wait, wait, I've got my Karl Crowe Handbook for China." And basically what they say is that all in all, travel on the regular routes is as safe in China as in any other part of the world. Robbers and pirates exist, of course, and there is usually a revolution or rebellion going on in some part of the country. But these things add zest rather than danger to the journey. So you're reading that, and you've got your wife and kids there, and you're thinking, this is going to be a great trip. I mean, this is like the Lonely Planet guide at the time. So it's not just the railroad companies that were promoting tourism or promoting that it was safe for businessmen and businesswomen and reporters to travel across the country, but you had guidebooks as well. And on top of that, the train had 17 guards on board with machine gun placements on top of the carriages.
Well, the description reminded me of descriptions of luxury trains in Europe, such as the Orient Express, but the Orient Express didn't come with machine gun emplacements on it.
I mean, but they felt secure. People felt secure. But there was trouble brewing in the heartland, and this is something that the government had to deal with, and they felt suppression campaigns was the way to do it. That ended up being the final straw for Sun Myao, the bandit chief, and his fellow bandit army of 1,000, soldiers.
We'll come back to Sun Myao. What about John Powell, the journalist who was on the train? Because I don't know if this is unusual for his time, but he seems like a bit of a Sinophile in that he not so much embraces the local culture, but he takes a genuine interest in it. He's not dismissive of his hosts. So what can you tell me about John Powell?
I mean, Powell was someone, in addition to a number of other correspondents and reporters that were on the train, they were people that were familiar with China. They were writing stories all the time about banditry, about the warlords, about, revolutions going on within the country. So, I mean, Powell was somebody that knew very well what was happening. I mean, most of the time he would be writing stories that were kind of negative about what was happening. But actually, one of the reasons he was on the train was for a very positive story. He was going north to cover a reclamation project that was being financed by the American Red Cross. But Powell was somebody that knew China very well. He had been there by that time about 6 years and had a lot of respect, a lot of empathy for the Chinese people, and actually to have him on board and somebody that was, held hostage for 37 days actually was something that supported the story being told around the world. But Powell, as well as some of the other people on board that train, had a lot of respect for China, had a lot of respect for the Chinese people.
What about the other passengers on the train who become characters in the story?
I mean, again, imagine yourself in the train station and you look around the room and you're seeing folks like members of the Shanghai Jewish business community, a very large group of young men, bankers, stockbrokers, very well dressed and sophisticated that were there. And they too were on the train. You also saw Lucy Aldrich, who is the sister-in-law of John D. Rockefeller Jr. She was there with both her secretary as well as another member of her group. And they were dressed, in what looked like Easter bonnets. So they were a little bit out of place, not dressed for an overnight train ride. But why she was there which this was her second trip to China, her second circumnavigation of the globe, and she was on her way to Peking to buy fabrics, antiques and so forth. So she was an avid collector of Asian textiles, and so that was the reason that she was on her way up to Peking. She felt very much at home in China. Part of that was because her brother-in-law, John D. Rockefeller Jr., ran a company that was very well established all throughout China, selling kerosene and other products for a Standard Oil Company of New York.
Amazing.
So in addition to Aldrich and then the what we call the Shanghai Jewish cousins, there was a lawyer that was very well known by the name of G.D. Musso, who had some kind of, you know, shady clients like warlords, you know, gun runners, and you know, he represented those that operated the casinos. He represented, you know, prostitutes. And he was also a big proponent of Mussolini in 1923. And actually, after he left China a few years after the incident, started doing promotional films about Mussolini. You had honeymooners, you had two U.S. Army majors and their families, who actually, they were stationed in the Philippines. So at the they're in the Philippines at the time, the U.S. had several army bases that, following the Spanish-American War, they were on their way back home after their two-year tour of duty in the Philippines, taking their families, their kids, through China to see, you know, the historical China, exotic China.
Given the situation at the time, with all these foreign nationals on board the train, there's a lot of wealth on display. This incident takes place, I believe, 4 months after the inauguration of the Peking Express. Do you think that it was inevitable that something like this would happen?
In some respects, yes, because of the political situation, the chaotic situation going on, and also because the warlords were out of control, you know, in terms of their, you know, the bandit suppression campaigns that they were engaging in. So in some respects, yeah, this was a situation that could have been anticipated.
I guess it represents quite a juicy target for any bandits or group of bandits, so there must be valuables on board. But I think that Sun Myel has a different set of objectives and a different agenda to the average bandit. So could you tell us a bit about Sun Myel?
Yeah, Sun Myel's agenda was more social, more political than economic. He was not, I mean, as you would define banditry, as somebody that was a robber or a thief, you know, Sun Myel was less interested in economics than he was a politics. His goal was actually to have the warlord armies removed from his hometown, his region in southern Shandong. He wanted to stop the suppression campaigns. He wanted the warlords removed. He wanted his group of men to be recognized by the central government, by the Peking government, as those that were controlling the region. He felt that this was the way to save the villagers, to save, you know, where he lived from the oppressive campaigns by the warlords. And so that his agenda was clearly social in nature, political in nature, but he also aligned himself with some traditional bandits. There was a group led by Popo Lu, who had about 300 men in the bandit army. They were more traditional bandits, more interested in ransom, more interested in opium and alcohol than actually having a political agenda. But Sun Myel was more interested in getting reinstated into an army, his own army that he controlled.
Yes, a lot of the passengers describe him as quite a charismatic figure.
Absolutely. I mean, he was able to lead his men to, you know, to derail the train. I mean, he was in control of a very large group of men, and they were all loyal to him, as well as to coordinate with Popo Lu and those that were more, you know, undisciplined. So he had the leadership skills to manage 1,000 bandits and successfully derailing the train, you know, robbing the train of valuables, as well as to lead the hostages across the countryside, you know, and engage in a 37-day hostage crisis.
Well, the different values of the Bad Army and what they're after reflected in the things that they steal from the train and how they go about it. Because they're quite different. Some of them are after money, and some of them are after ransom money from the hostages. And some of them are going through the train and just ripping out all the fittings and features and all the things that are shiny from it.
Yeah, I mean, the strategy was the first wave to go in was to take the valuables like the watches, the coins, the jewelry, and they needed that. It was Sun Miao that needed that to buy ammunition from the corrupt Chinese army. You know, he needed,
wow.
I mean, so he needed the ammunition, so the jewelry and the coins and those valuables, he needed to do that. The second wave that came in and took the blankets and took the pots and pans and the light fixtures and all of that, those items, they would barter with the villagers for safe passage and food as they were, you know, as they marched across the countryside. You know, there was an agenda with what they took from the train. Specifically, the valuables would be used to buy ammunition, and then the other items of less value but more valuable to the villagers, that was something that they were able to negotiate for safe passage and food, which they need to continue across the countryside. And if the third wave, of course, was to take the hostages. And out of those, they took over 25 foreigners and about 75 Chinese that they dragged across the countryside. They ignored the Chinese that were in those passengers in the third-class cars because they viewed them as not having any, you know, any value. So they focused on the foreigners and they focused on the high-wealth Chinese.
It's a really carefully planned raid. They do come across as people who know what they're doing in order to, for example, dismantle the track in such a way that doesn't cause the engine driver to suspect anything. What I was wondering was, had they had any practice at this before?
No, I mean, it was something that was rumored to have been. They had seen it in a Western movie as to how to derail the train.
Really?
But what they actually did was a couple of things. First of all, the day that they had chosen was when the police, the railway police, were mostly gone and the tracks were unprotected. You know, the railway police pretty much had all of the leaders of the railway police went up to Tianjin for the birthday party of the head of the railway police. So, Sun Miao and his spies were aware that the track was going to be effectively unguarded. So that was the first thing. The second thing, they chose a site which was on an incline and a curve where the train and the conductor actually had to slow down. And so what they did was they removed the fish plates, the steel plates that hold together the track in 16 locations. So when the train was going at 2:30, 2:40 in the morning, and it got to the point of derailment, they had to slow down because of the upgrade and because of the curve. Imagine the conductor had this very large headlight and everything looked fine. The track was still there. It did not look like it had been removed. But the moment they hit the site without the fish plates, the locomotive, very heavy locomotive, just sank into the embankment and stopped. And then all the cars behind that just started fishtailing. Some of them went into the countryside. Some of the cars tipped over. But that's how they stopped the train, how they derailed the train.
So this happens at 2:30 a.m.
Yep.
Well, I guess that most of the passengers are asleep at this time.
Right. And they were all, a lot of them were in their pajamas. A lot of them had removed their shoes. And so when they were taken hostage, they were not prepared to march across the countryside. On top of that, when the bandits initially attacked the train, they broke a lot of glass. They were tearing apart the passenger cars. And so you had people that had no time to get dressed, had no time to put their shoes on. So a lot of folks were just completely unprepared for a march across the countryside.
So if we look at some of the people on the opposite side, so this is the army of the state that's chasing down the bandits and trying to go on this journey of extermination against the bandit crews. What's their motivation? Are they following orders, or is there a personal vendetta involved here?
Yeah, I mean, the warlord of Shandong province, his name was General Tian, he wanted Su Miao wiped out. In fact, he ordered Su Miao's brother to be executed, and that was one of the final straws, you know, that drove Su Miao to derail the train, you know, was the execution of his brother. So it was a vendetta. And then General Tian's deputy in Lincheng, who went by the nickname of Black-hearted General Ho, he was someone that was also very vicious. And so when he finally got the news of the derailment, they went after the bandits, they went after the hostages, and they were firing and shooting, you know, with the hostages in the crossfire. And that was a big risk. You know, it was a huge risk. Sun Miao was trying to get them to stop shooting, to withdraw. But General Ho, as well as General Tian, did not want to stop. And they felt that the use of force was the only way to stop Su Miao. And if that put the hostages at risk, so be it. Part of that is why the foreign government stepped in and said, you know, your strategy's not working. The use of force is only going to drive the bandits and the hostages further into the countryside.
Speaking about the countryside, one of the things that I felt was just really sorry for the villagers and the peasants along the way, because they seem to be caught between two very aggressive powers.
Absolutely. I mean, that was one of the things that a lot of the hostages wrote about in their diaries. As they were being dragged across the countryside, they could see village after village after village that was just leveled. I mean, and they were burnt to the ground. There was no animals, no people. I mean, they saw the destruction, and they could see why, you know, they started realizing that the villagers were all caught in the crossfire of this, and that they were, it was something that the destruction was just appalling. A lot of the hostages started to empathize with, you know, the bandits, you know, because they could see that their hometowns were being just leveled.
Do you think that, these people have been traveling from urban environment in Shanghai with a mix of different cultures, but do you think many of them had thought about the plight of the Chinese peasants in the countryside before?
You know, I think a number of the passengers, including Lucy Aldridge, including many of those that were, you know, wealthy and prominent folks from Shanghai, it was an eye-opener. It was like a transformation for them. At first, they're like, these guys are just a bunch of criminals here. And then started to sympathize with them and realizes that they, you know, they were just starving poor people that were just trying to earn a living. The two U.S. Army majors, you know, they started to realize that these people were oppressed, something that they took note in and wrote about significantly in their diaries. Someone like Lucy Aldridge also initially, what she wrote about is how she was, in some respects, making fun of the bandits. You know, she thought the whole thing was a joke. Her impression of a bandit was like, you know, these guys were just filthy animals. But over time, and she started to empathize with them and say, these people have nothing. They have nothing.
I think you make a point with Lucy Aldrich specifically that, for example, she's trying to hide her precious jewels from the bandits, but they're not actually worth that much to her. She just doesn't want the bandits to have them.
Yeah, she took it upon herself to try to hide her family jewels, because initially it's not so much the value, but she was basically saying, I don't want to give them my family jewelry that I've had for years, my mother's rings and so forth. So I think initially, when she was pushing back, you know, at the bandits, she was not going to give them up. But it wasn't until she actually was taken in by the villagers that she felt that, you know, these people have nothing. Over the course of her confinement, you know, her detention, she started to have a lot more feelings and understandings for the people that were basically taking care of her, providing her with food and water.
A lot of the listeners to this are from the UK, so what can you tell me about the British people involved in the story?
Well, that there were a number of British citizens that were taken hostage, and there was also they were very the British government sent one of its consular affairs officers to the site to support the rescue operation. So they were the British government was very, very much involved. The British Minister of China actually had a very hard time keeping a lot of rescue schemers that happened to be British from kind of interjecting themselves in the process just to try to see if they could get the British hostages released, you know, such as bribing the bandits and sending in British aircraft to, you know, to bomb the
Oh my
bandits and so
God.
forth. And so the British minister had kind of a fun time basically saying, stay out of this. We can't interfere with this. And so the role of the British minister, who was basically the ambassador at the time, was really interesting. And he had a very difficult job of getting all these adventurers from getting involved. On top of that, you had one of the most interesting characters. One of the hostages was a gentleman from Manchester, whom he was basically sent to Asia by his doctors to get away from it all and to take a holiday. Unfortunately,
The holiday from hell.
his name was William Smith, and Mr. Smith was 64 years old. He was probably the oldest gentleman that was taken hostage, but he actually was a drug addict. He was very much addicted to a lot of the different drugs that were around at the time that were prescribed for a number of different things. But his doctors basically sent him to the Orient saying, you know, get to wean yourself off of this stuff. And so by the time he showed up in southern Shandong on his around the world tour, he had been weaned himself off the drugs. And so he was drug free until he was taken hostage. And
Oh
then, you know, and so
no.
when while he was a hostage, he was asking for all sorts of narcotics to basically help him mellow out. And all of the other hostages were concerned because here's this guy wandering out in the countryside, and the bandits, as well as the hostages, were really worried about this guy wandering away from the bandit camp. And so, if there ever is a movie that's made about the Peking Express, the person that plays the role of William Smith is going to have a fun time with that
I think
character.
that absolutely should be a film made of this. It's prime material. I don't know
Yes,
why I
exactly.
haven't seen one yet.
Yeah, I mean, well, actually, there was a film. It's 1932, The Shanghai Express
Oh, wow, really? Okay.
that was remotely based on the incident, and the whole backstory on that was the guy that wrote the screenplay. His name is Harry Hervey. He happened to be on a cruise ship in 1923, working on the cruise ship, and like everyone else at the time, was reading the daily news coverage. And it inspired him to write the screenplay for the Shanghai Express. But the Shanghai Express, a great movie, but it was very much remotely based upon it. It was nominated for Best Picture. It was the highest grossing film in 1932. It actually won the Academy Award for cinematography. It was a great film, but it did not have bandits. It did not march across the countryside. It was very, very different from the Peking Express, but it's still a great
Well,
movie.
I see what they've done there. It's that classic Hollywood based on real events thing, where so instead of going towards Peking, it's going the opposite direction towards Shanghai. So yeah, they've changed that to begin with, and then
Yes.
yeah, all based on real events in inverted commas. With this in mind, for you as a writer, how do you tackle a true story like this and avoid falling into the idea of creating cookie cutter goodies and baddies out of people, out of real people?
Well, I mean, there was a wealth of information that I had to work with all the letters, with the diaries, with all the statements by both the hostages, the rescuers, all the people that were involved in this, the media reports. So there was a lot of materials that I had to work with in developing the dialogue from start to finish. And it also was a challenge for me. There was a challenge because I had different points of view. Not one hostage, not one rescuer had the full picture. And so when someone wrote in their diary about their experiences, it was just their experiences when other things were happening to other people. So as a writer, the challenge of trying to bring it all together so that I had everyone's points of view that were acknowledged in some way. I would be able to get points of view for the good guys as well as the bad guys. And there were good people and bad people on both sides of the whole story.
There's a fascinating sequence that I think really highlights the poverty aspect when one of the bandits demonstrates how to eat an egg raw by sucking out the innards from it. Because I'd never thought about that before, because it makes sense now. If you've got nothing to cook with, it just makes sense to suck the insides out. But at first it was like, whoa, I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah, I mean, that makes a lot of sense, you know, because it's not, I mean, a raw egg is full of nutrients. It's good for you. And to do it without, if you crack the egg, you might lose some of the yolk, or you might lose, you know, some of the whites, the parts of the egg. So popping a hole in it, sucking it out was probably one of the, you know, most efficient ways of getting all of the nutrients from one egg. You know, and very efficient in the way they did that. So
yeah, it sort of highlighted that these are desperate people on the run, and you know, they just have nothing. They don't have any cooking utensils or any means to like set up permanently. They're living by their wits. They're living in fear all the time. It really highlighted that to me, just how poor they were.
Yeah, I mean, they were very, very, very poor. I mean, they're, and that was you know, and even getting clean water was an issue for them. And there's one scene in the book where they all shared one, what they called a young cow, but it turned out to be Shandong dog. And it kind of had them all realize how poor these people were, because traditionally dogs were not used for food. But in a famine district in Shandong, you eat everything you can get your hands on. And so the dogs are usually in that area were used for guard dogs or for security and so forth. But when it came down to starvation, you know, there's things that they were eating, ravens, they were eating, you know, local dogs and so forth. I mean, these people were living below the poverty line. It was a famine district. And that's something that the hostages, those prominent hostages from Shanghai and from around the world began to realize that this is, you know, we're really in the rural areas of this country. But at the same time, all of them wrote about how beautiful this was, how the mountains, you know, were incredible. In addition to, I mean, there was ways that people were, they would get local cherries and local other food products that they were able to find just by cultivated agricultural land as they got deeper into the countryside. So, but they made the most of it. But also at the same time, you know, you had this American rescue mission that helped provide food for all of the hostages, both the foreign as well as the Chinese. And that kind of resolved things after the first 10 days. They were getting provisions from the rescue operation.
The district, this area of China, it does seem to have been contested, because am I right in thinking that it was partially controlled by Germany before the First World War, and the events of the First World War change who's in charge of the state?
Well, after the Boxer Rebellion in 1900,
yes, okay,
Germany took possession of what is now Tsingtao. Now, they did not have possession of all of Shandong, but they did have control of the east-west railway line between Qingdao and Jinan. They also had the right to build missions, and so there was a lot of German-supported missions, you know, Catholic missions throughout the country. So Germany did have, in some respects, effective control. Part of it was because of the East-West rail line.
Oh.
But after World War I, with the Treaty of Versailles, Japan took possession of Qingdao, and they had possession actually until just about 5 months before the Peking Express. So they gave up possession. The Japanese gave back possession of Qingdao to China in December of 1922.
Mm.
You know, but there was still a lot of Japanese interest in the area. So the province wasn't really contested, but there was a lot of competing interests there for sure.
In the book, before the derailment happens, there are Japanese passengers on board who get off the train before the incident. Is that foreshadowing the events? Is that linked?
Well, there was definitely some Japanese passengers that were that boarded the train, and they also got word some way and got off the train. So there was not one Japanese passenger that was on that train when it was held up. So there was definitely, it was more than just a rumor that there was the Japanese passengers, prominent ones, including one of the leaders from a local chamber of commerce in Japan, who got off the train at the last stop before the holdup. Now, there was rumors that the Japanese government had a hand, you know, somehow had a hand in the incident, you know, that they were either supporting the bandits or that they were providing weapons and so forth. The U.S. government did its own analysis after it was over, and they said, no, the Tokyo government did not, you know, have a formal role in the incident. But they still, the Japanese passengers on board were definitely tipped off and got off the train. And that might be because the Japanese gunrunners were running a very successful operation in that area at the time, and they basically wanted to protect their own kind from being caught up in the whole issue.
You've mentioned that the bandits just ignored the third-class Chinese passengers, but from the eyewitness accounts, it does seem that the first and second-class Chinese passengers had a really horrible time and were treated very, very badly by the bandits.
The Chinese passengers that were taken hostage were treated horribly because they were considered to be from the Mandarin class. You know, these were the high wealth Chinese that were either in first class or second class, and they were treated quite badly by the bandits because some of the bandits looked at them as supporters of the warlords, supporters of the gentry, the landowners. They got the brunt. You know, a lot of these Chinese passengers that were murdered by the bandits, all of the hostages that wrote diaries and letters observed that how badly they were treated. But they were mostly the high wealth, you know, Chinese that were in the first or second classes.
With the hostage situation, what was the ongoing impact on railway travel in China at this time?
After the incident, it really impacted the ability of the express trains to regain their confidence of consumers, so to speak. People were very, very reluctant to ride the trains, so it did have an impact. Mm. And there was a lot of organizations, such as the American Chamber of Commerce and other business organizations that were calling upon the foreign governments to take control over the trains. You know, so there was a huge drop in confidence with the public, especially with the foreigners. You know, it really had an impact on the ability of the train system to allow people to feel that they were safe and secure. Unfortunately, you know, within years after the railroads ended up being the choice way of transporting troops during the civil wars, during the invasion of Japan, and the Japanese were bombing the railway. So the railway system was damaged, or it was used in multiple wars, you know, and battles that took place, including in the southern Shandong. Was one of the biggest battles of the, you know, the Japanese war against China. Mm. The entire railroad system was, you know, thrown into chaos after this.
What would you like readers to take away from this story, apart from the historical aspect of it? What do you want them to think about afterwards?
I think probably one thing is that this is just a great train story, and that everybody loves a good train story. I mean, think about all of the movies, think about all of the stories that come out of Hollywood. It's just a great train story. It's a people story. Now, there are takeaways with implications for today, you know, that have some relevance, like, you know, you still have the government in 2023, still has issues with corruption, still has issues with the economic divide. And so there's a lot of things in 1923 that China's still confronted with in 2023. But I think overall, the big takeaway that I would like people to get out of this, that it's in some respects, it's a fun story about China. It's an interesting period, even though it's chaotic, even though it could be considered a true crime story, it's just a great train story.
An adventure, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And captures people's interest. I'm not trying to have a history lesson here. I'm not trying to reflect all of the political implications of what happened. But it's a people story because in writing this, I was basing it on the diaries of real people, of ordinary people that were caught up in an international incident that impacted China as well as impacted China's place in the world.
100 years later, how is this story remembered in China today?
That's a very interesting question because in that region of southern Shandong, the collective memory is not about 1923. If you ask people on the streets in southern Shandong about historical incidences, they focus on mostly in the 1930s when Japan invaded. And so their collective memory is mostly about that time frame. Having said that, there's more talk about this now that the book is out. I've actually heard from the local tourism authorities. I've heard from a lot of people within the Zhaotuang area that are interested in this as a way of maybe driving tourism and commerce. And they're like, yeah, this was an interesting time. It was a chaotic time. But much of the architecture and clearly the landscape and terrain remains exactly the same as it did in 1923. The temples that are the subject of the story, remain the same. The same
Wow.
exact Ginkgo tree that is on the temple's ground in what is called Sanqing Temple. In the book, it's called the Temple of the Clouds. That tree, over a 1,000 years old, it's the same tree where the hostages and the bandits slept under, is still there. It's a beautiful, beautiful place. It is something that could make a story today if the people of southern Shandong embrace it. Now, on my trips, I've been there, 10 times and meet with the locals and talk to them. I'm finding that more and more of the local people like to say that they were, the descendants of bandits. It's kind of.
Yeah, I guess it's a bit like saying, well, I've got Viking blood in me.
It's almost a badge of honor for them to say that. I mean, 10 years ago, they would not say that. But today it's becoming more of a thing that people talk about. So, yeah, we'll see. Maybe there'll be more discussions and more people at the local level that are interested in the story. And then they can get beyond, what the collective memory is, which is focused on Japan and Japan's invasion. They can get beyond that and think about some of the things that took place in the 20s and before.
So the book is out now, it's available,
Yeah.
as well as the audiobook, which is read by David Shi. It is brilliant. I highly recommend that. What's going to happen next?
Right now, the book came out on April 4th. The 100th anniversary is on May 5th. And I'm actually going back to China next week. And I'll be there, for the May 5th date. I'm going to be doing an event in Shanghai at the Shanghai Railway Museum, which is where the Shanghai Nanking Railway Station is. And so I'll be doing an event there and then taking a tour group to southern Shandong for the 6th and 7th, which again, that is the
Wow.
100th anniversary of the derailment and hold up. And so that's the next step for this, is just driving the message about, the whole incident. So I'll be back in China for the month of May,
Wow, excellent.
on the story. So that's how things are going to proceed going forward.
It's very exciting. I'm so happy to be able to join us and tell us about the story on the podcast. Really urge everybody listening to this to go and read the book or listen to the audiobook. It's a fantastic adventure story with a train at its heart. James, thanks so much for joining us today on Railway Mania.
Thank you.